Sex and death, love and hate. This hour we're talking about apparent opposites and how closely they can be connected. Laura Waterman knows this intimately. She adored her husband Guy. You might say they were soulmates, inseparable for nearly 30 years of marriage. But Guy became almost unbearable to live with as he sank into a profound depression. And then one day he hiked to the top of one of his favorite mountains in New Hampshire, in the middle of winter, and sat down to die in sub-zero temperatures. What makes the story especially poignant is that Laura knew he was going to do this. In her memoir called Losing the Garden, she searches to answer the question, how could she let her husband kill himself? To find out what she discovered, Steve Paulson went to see Laura Waterman at her home in eastern Vermont.
Laura Waterman's memoir consumed me like few other books I've read. Knowing the ending certainly pulled me along, but it's actually a story bursting with life, and Laura's husband, Guy Waterman, is one of the great characters of recent decades, a driven, obsessed, gifted man, but also someone crippled by inner demons. Laura and Guy were back to the land Vermonters before it was fashionable, living off the grid for 29 years, while also writing a series of hiking and climbing books. In so many ways, they carved out an exemplary life together. So how do we explain the suicide at the end? That's the question that haunted me when I went to see Laura Waterman in East Corinth, Vermont. Laura lives in a log house and keeps a huge flower garden just outside her front door. Inside, the house is filled with mementos, including an ice axe over the wood stove and dozens of pictures of her life with Guy.
Let's see. One shows us cutting down a very large ash tree, it was. Then there are some climbing pictures.
Laura met Guy Waterman in 1969, just after she discovered the thrill of rock climbing. Guy was already an avid climber. Both were living in New York City. He wrote speeches for GE executives. She worked in publishing. But their hearts were elsewhere, on the side of a cliff.
It was as close as we humans can come to flying. I guess climbing can become addicting, and I became addicted from my first climb.
Guy and Laura were soon spending all their time together, climbing on weekends and dreaming of the day they could live out in the country. It turned out they both loved books as well, and Guy had actually memorized most of Milton's Paradise Lost.
And I was very impressed with that.
So what was the attraction to Paradise Lost for Guy?
He was very attracted to the character of Satan, and he admired Satan's individuality, his refusal to be pushed around.
Laura and Guy hadn't originally planned on becoming homesteaders. They just wanted to live cheaply near the mountains. After they got married, they bought a small piece of land in the Vermont countryside, and inspired by Thoreau's Walden and Helen and Scott Nearing's Living the Good Life, they set about becoming completely self-sufficient. They even gave their place a name, Barra, and Guy soon started his own Book of Barra, where he laid out his objectives.
To live simply, cheaply, unhurriedly, concerned with basics like food and shelter and fuel, and to maintain our interest in climbing and hiking.
Well, it's also striking the kind of home that you set up. I mean, no electricity, no running water. You ended up using an outhouse for 29 years. And in fact, what all this cost, it's amazing how little your expenses were. I mean, you say that you lived on $200 a month for years, and then with inflation, that kind of crept up to about $250 a month, which came to about $2,400 a year over nearly three decades. Well, not too many people can do that.
Well, I think people can do just about anything that they set their mind to doing. And we did find a way of supplementing what we had in the bank with writing.
So what was a typical day like? Can you run me through your schedule?
Yes, because we did have a schedule. Guy always got up at 4:15, precisely, but I was not an early riser. And usually we were out of the house and working by 8 o'clock. And then we would spend from 8 till noon either doing garden work or wood collecting, or if it were sugaring season, we'd be down at the sugar shed. Or maybe we would be writing for the morning.
Now, what's fascinating is A lot of people would consider this very onerous. I mean, just nonstop work, what some people would call chores, hour after hour. But you say that Guy would describe this as playing in the woods.
Well, he said that that kind of play that you have as children, if you can find it as an adult, you know, you'll be happy. I mean, as he said to me, that he'd found someone to play in the woods with.
Well, you say there was another ritual, daily ritual, that you had together, and that was reading books out loud after dinner.
Yeah, it started because, as a guy called me, I was president of the slow eaters. And it's true, I'm a very slow eater. And he was a very fast eater. So he would finish his dinner and then begin reading.
This sounds like such a throwback to a 19th century lifestyle. It's almost as if you had dropped out of the 20th century.
Well, I think we really had.
Guy Waterman was the kind of man who needed to throw himself into big projects. One of the biggest was climbing every 4,000-foot mountain in New Hampshire in the winter from all four directions. It took him years, but he did summit all 48 peaks four times each, often bushwhacking his way up the mountain through snow and ice when there were no trails. To say Guy was driven would barely begin to tell the story. He was also an obsessive record keeper, recording and measuring everything they did, how many potatoes and carrots they gathered in their garden, how many cords of wood they collected, every bird they saw and book they read. They had three thermometers in different locations, which they checked several times a day, and they kept meticulous records of rain, snow, and wind.
It was a control thing for him. I mean, it pushed out bad thoughts or pushed away what was probably a depression for him.
Guy never used the word depression to describe his increasingly bleak moods, but he did talk about his demons and did everything he could to keep them at bay. Playing the piano seemed to help. In fact, the music we're now listening to is a recording of Guy from the mid-70s. Playing the Steinway Grand he'd squeezed into the cabin was one way he could pour out his feelings when words failed him. Guy Waterman had been married once before, a marriage that produced three sons. He taught all three to be expert rock climbers, but two of his sons, Bill and Johnny, became deeply troubled and both died tragically young. Johnny's death during a solo climb of Alaska's Mount McKinley hit Guy especially hard. Earlier, Johnny had made a nearly impossible ascent, spending 145 days alone on Mount Hunter, a mountaineering feat that made him a climbing legend in Alaska, but left him feeling empty.
The way he looked at it was that if he was able to climb it by this extremely challenging route, that somehow it wasn't a worthy mountain.
The only worthy mountain would be one that would kill him.
That's correct.
And you say that Guy saw a lot of himself in Johnny.
Yes, well, that's what Guy said.
So why didn't Guy ever go to Alaska to try to help Johnny? Laura can only guess.
Guy couldn't face it. I think by trying to find out what Johnny's problems were, then he would have had to have faced what his own problems were. He couldn't do that. We never used the word depression, but it seems that Guy fell into a pretty profound depression after Johnny's death.
Did you talk about this with him, about how difficult life had become?
We tried to talk about it, but it was very difficult. You know, talking to me or trying to articulate what he felt just wasn't something Guy wanted to take on.
What about you, though? I mean, this must have been very hard for you once he started spiraling downwards. I mean, this must have affected your marriage.
It was hard. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, I thought, do I want to stay being married to Guy? And, you know, and the answer was yes. I mean, I really couldn't imagine not being with him.
Well, there are, I think, a couple of great mysteries in this story. One is why Guy never went for help, never to see a therapist, never to get some kind of psychiatric intervention. Why not?
He'd had a very bad experience with, you know, with a psychiatrist when he was a teenager. I think he was so burned by that earlier experience that it just wasn't a possibility. I don't think he could really confront what was so scary to him. And I think that he felt a great guilt and also shame.
Do you think he also felt responsible for the deaths of his two sons?
He never said he did, but I don't see how he could have not felt some responsibility.
Now, the other great mystery, as I read your book, was about you, was about why you didn't insist that he get help when it was so clear that he was deeply troubled. Why didn't you haul him off to a psychiatrist?
Guy wasn't the sort of person that you hauled off to a psychiatrist. I mean, certainly we talked about it, and he said no. If I had pushed on it, it would have broken up our marriage.
One day in 1998, Guy Waterman came back from a summer hike and, clearly shaken, told Laura that he'd climbed to the top of a cliff, intending to jump off, but couldn't. Laura was stunned, though not completely surprised, and told him if that's what he had to do, she had to be in a better place herself before he committed suicide.
I really think that that was the right thing to say to him. I mean, I wasn't saying, you can't do this. You know, if that's going to be your path, I have to make sure that I'm in a path that's satisfying for me. So in a sense, it opened up communication between us. And you know, we spent close to 18 months? We had 18 months together after that.
Laura and Guy spent the next year and a half saying goodbye to each other and the life they'd built together. They even designed a new house 2 miles away, which they called Laura's house, for the time when Guy would no longer be here. Laura says it was actually a healing time for both of them. And for all that she wished he would change his mind, she knew he wouldn't. And in some ways, that was also a relief. Guy did all he could to help her get ready for being on her own, and he left her a note.
Which was basically saying, I know you'll do your life well. It gave me permission, in a sense, to not feel guilt. I think the worst thing for me would have been if he had actually managed to jump off of Cannon Cliff that July 3rd.
Finally, on one of the coldest days of the year, February 6th, 2000, Guy hiked to the top of one of his favorite mountains in New Hampshire and froze to death overnight. It's the one day Laura still isn't able to talk about, though she offered to read a passage from her memoir about their last morning together.
The morning Guy leaves, what seemed like any ordinary winter morning to someone looking in the window of our small cabin in the clearing. I prepare our hot cereal of road oats, wheat germ, raisins, dried milk, and maple syrup on the wood stove. Guy dishes out applesauce, which I canned that fall. Our voices are low as we sit at the table, the usual easy back and forth. He springs up, ever the fast eater. He wants to be off by 8. I watch him slide in his 2 canteens, one with water, the other holding half alcohol and half water, to make the job easier, as we've talked about. The sight of him, within touching distance, on the ash log is so utterly familiar that I can't make it real that in a few moments my husband is going to walk out the door for the last time. This time, you won't be coming home to tell me the tale, how it all comes out, I say, and send him a small smile. He looks up and grins back, and I feel the connection between us deepen. I won't even be able to send you a postcard, he says, continuing the joke. And when he looks up again, the concerned look is back, and he says, make bread today, Laura. I stare at him, thinking this is a strange thing to say, but in fact, the old loaf is down to a few stale slices. We need bread, or rather, I will need bread.
Guy Waterman's memorial service turned out to be one of the biggest the local village had ever seen. And Guy, being Guy, had planned for the occasion. A few months earlier, he sat down at the piano and recorded the music he wanted for his service, the music we're now listening to. The ceremony turned into a celebration of Guy's life.
I was was just so stunned by the outpouring for Guy after his death. I mean, the number of letters that I received, and, you know, there was just a huge amount of love. I mean, in a sense, that was a really sad part about it, because that love had been there all along, and he really was not able to accept that.
It's now been, what, 9 years since Guy died. You've written a memoir. You've obviously thought about this a great deal. How do you look back on your marriage with Guy now?
Well, it seems strange to say, but in a way, I wouldn't have changed anything. He was the person for me.
You describe it as the great love story.
Well, maybe it was.
Laura Waterman's memoir is called Losing the Garden, The Story of a Marriage. All the music in this piece was played by Guy Waterman. Steve Paulson talked with Laura in East Corinth, Vermont, in the house she designed with Guy shortly before his death. Today, Laura Waterman hikes and gardens and writes, and is an active member of the Waterman Fund, a nonprofit group that supports education and stewardship of the alpine areas in the Northeast.